A podcast of the cinema.
Welcome to you, Alonzo Duralde.
Thank you, Dave White, and same to you.
You're the film critic of who? What's your deal?
I don't know how many years it's going to take you for you to learn this stuff. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap.
Right.
I also review movies and recap TV shows.
That's correct.
At What the Flick.
That's what you
on
do.
On the Young Turks Network.
Listen, here's the situation. I remember a lot of things about you. For example, I'm married to you.
Yes.
I always remember that.
Well, yay.
But then when someone says to me, what are his credentials? Prove them to me. I think.
Do I just try to laminate a card for you? And
that would be helpful.
Have that handy?
Yeah. Because honestly, you being the big boss man of everywhere you go.
Please.
In terms of film criticism, come on. Don't be coy. You being a fancy Dan outside of this house is of such little interest to me that all I care about is what happens. I'm like when you play peekaboo with a 2-year-old, like, oh, he's gone. What happens now? Did he disappear forever? I guess he did. Like, when you're here in front of me, it's very important. It's vital.
Ah. Thank you.
When we're doing this show together, also very vital. When we're on the radio together, incredibly important. Because I have you in front of my face.
I see.
I remember who you are and what you do then.
Well, I'm about to leave town for a week. Should I, like, leave a photo up
there
or something?
You might need to leave a picture.
Maybe with, like, a little voice recording thing on it. So you'd be like, hi, Dave. I'm your husband, Alonzo. You may recall me from such marriages as this one.
Your credentials, what you do with your life outside of these doors is, I have to remind myself every time afresh. I'm a film critic too.
You are a long.
I do the same thing you do.
I was getting to that.
Except less importantly, you are in fewer places.
You are a long standing film critic as well. Currently, your stuff appears at The Wrap.
At The Wrap.
And periodically we go on KCRW together.
And now we're on Pop Rocket.
And sometimes we go on Pop Rocket together or separately.
You are more on Pop Rocket.
Lately, yes, but we've gone on jointly, and you've gone on your own a couple times, so, you know.
I'll be substitutioning for you this week.
Yeah.
Because you leave for Venice, Italy, Europe tomorrow.
It is true.
And until then, we have not wide releases of film to
pretty
talk
much,
about.
Yeah. This is the ass end of summer where they're just kind of like chucking whatever they got.
I mean, big movies did open this weekend, did they not? Did wide releases
I mean,
open this weekend?
All Saints was a wide release.
What even was that?
It's like it's a faith-based movie.
I want to talk about it in the past tense because
we're never seeing it.
I don't know anything.
It's a faith-based movie with Northern Exposure's John Corbett as a
Sex in the City's John Corbett.
Sex in the City John Pine. Yeah. Bo Derek's John Corbett as a real life dude who apparently was a new Episcopalian pastor, and he gets assigned this church that's about to be sold off, but he decides instead to rally the local migrant community to turn the church land into a farm so it can become self-sufficient.
All right. Yeah.
I think that's what it's about.
Wait a second.
That's what the movie's about.
I'm sorry, is this like the Dorothy Day story or something?
Well, probably not. I'm sure it's made by something called Affirm Films, so I doubt there's much of a lefty agenda at play.
So this isn't the gross God's Not Dead people.
No, it is not a pure flicks joint.
They're disgusting.
Yes, not them. Somebody else.
And
this one's getting okay reviews. Christy Lemire actually kind of dug it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez. See, I vowed after the election that I wasn't going to watch any more of these films.
Right.
Like, before that man became the president, I was, as you know, really into seeing all the Christian movies.
Yes.
Including the dumbest and worst of them.
You were fascinated by the dog whistles on display.
Because that is how I was raised, and that is where I come from, and I am fascinated by their current incarnation in the culture.
And how they communicate to each other.
Which I was an incarnation that, for the record, I find almost entirely toxic.
Yes.
But this doesn't sound horrifying.
Yeah, this one might fall more in that miracles from heaven category of not terrible. In fact, that might even be the company, because it's Sony's releasing it, and they put out Miracles from Heaven, so it might be those folks.
Maybe I'll give it a shot later, after we have run Donald Trump out of the White House. On a rail.
I will count the days.
And by we, I mean literally every person in this country. Working together in concert.
I would like to think of such a magical
to
day happening.
To ruin him.
But I think that...
That's what I want.
I think he's going to always have a chunk of his base who, no matter what, is going to... He could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and they would still support him.
Those people can go to hell.
Well...
that's there. I said
some
that.
Some might say they're already there.
Goodbye, new listeners.
If they came to us from Pop Rocket, I'm sure, you know, they're down.
They may have just come to us from the atmosphere.
That's true, in which case, well...
We just offended you.
We gave it our best shot.
We didn't.
Not really, not even close. Then the other, I think Leap was fairly wide this weekend as well.
I had an interest in seeing Leap.
Just because you wanted to hear
Cut to the Feeling. I am a big fan of Carly Rae Jepsen.
Sure.
She's a voice in the film.
Yes.
But she also contributed the coolest pop song of the summer to this film.
Yes. Though the film is set in like 19th century France.
It doesn't matter. You got to cut to the feeling, even if it's 19th century France.
Yes. Not to be confused with What a Feeling, which is also probably the last song you should do to audition for fancy ballet school.
But here's the thing. The reviews have been uniformly, like, mean.
Yeah.
Almost angry reviews.
Robert Abele reviewed it for The Wrap, and he was kind.
I'm no longer curious about what they do with the song Cut to the Feeling, or what they do with Carly Rae Jepsen's vocal
performance. Because you can just hear Cut to the Feeling whenever you want to hear Cut to the Feeling.
Anytime I want.
Yeah. So we're talking about some smaller...
I'm going to stop recording this podcast right now.
No, you're not.
And listen to Cut to the Feeling.
You can listen to Cut to the Feeling later when we're done.
Carly Rae Jepsen.
That'll be your treat when we're finished. You can listen to Cut to the Feeling.
All right.
We're talking about smaller indie releases this week. One of which, actually, the big, the top per screen average of the weekend is a film called Beach Rats, which we screened at Outfest. It premiered at Sundance this year. I like it a lot. Dave hasn't seen it yet, and no. I think it's a movie that we should both talk about because it is an interesting gay film. And so I think once you see it, we'll circle back to it.
We can't do it until you come back from. Venice. Uh-huh. So here's what I want you to do.
What?
Give me like a minute or two on this.
Okay.
Tell me about it. And by me, I mean everyone listening.
The world.
Because I already know what it's about.
Okay.
And tell me, you know, what you think. And then while you're in Venice, I will watch it.
Okay.
Because the publicist did send me personally a screening link.
Yes.
That I have not yet had a minute to sit down and watch.
Right. Well, if it turns out that it is expired, go see it in a theater because it is really gorgeous.
I will do that.
It's set in sort of the unhip kind of ocean end of Brooklyn. There's this kid who's like, I think, a recent high school graduate, probably.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you, but I'm in the middle as we speak. I'm shelling peas.
Yes, you are.
On the microphone. I'm shelling peas for dinner, and I just opened up a pod that had no peas in it, and I'm furious.
And Getty's took them.
I want to take it back to the grocery store and say, look what you've done.
How could you charge me for this?
I paid for this. I paid a few cents for this, and now I'm very angry.
Chicanery!
Anyway, I just had to... I'd invent that.
All right, thank you. Right. Okay, so this is Eliza Hittman's second film. She did a movie called It Felt Like Love, which was about a teen girl coming to terms, you know, coming into her sexuality and making some bad choices. And this movie is about a guy who is, you know, hangs around with his friends, and they're sort of like shirtless toughs on the beach and that kind of thing.
Those are my favorite kind of toughs.
Petty criminal types.
Yeah.
You know, he gets stoned a lot. But then when he's on his own, he cruises online for dudes. And so, yeah, so it's a movie about him sort of trying to figure out who he is and what he's about. And, it, you know, when it premiered at Sundance, there was... there were several writers, including one at The Wrap, who was like, this is the, you know, this is not the, they were objecting to the kind of gay narrative that it was.
Meaning what?
Well,
because I haven't read any of the
There are acts of violence in the film that stem from the fact that he is in the closet and that he is trying to sort of keep his two lives separate.
Like gay bashing kind of stuff that he participates in? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Well, guess what?
Well, and yeah, and I even had a couple
Let me tell you all something about real life.
I even had a couple of people at Outfest who came up to me after the screening, like, well, you know, the way things are right now, is this the kind of image we want to put out in the world? And I said,
yes.
I don't think this is a thing that has anything that makes us look bad. This is a movie that's a condemnation of the closet.
Yep.
It is a condemnation of a society that forces people to hide who they are and live these double lives.
The truth is always what you want to put out into the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think it's a very honest film. It's beautifully shot. The lead performance, this guy named Harris Dixon, who's British but is very convincingly a New Yorker.
They always do that.
I know.
The
there's
British
so much,
people can do American accents.
They're way better at that than we are at them.
Than we can, yeah.
I think it's a really powerful film, and people should totally see it.
All right. My link is about to expire.
Okay.
They did send me an email about
Get on it.
Saying, stop shelling peas and start watching Beach Rats.
Dave White.
That was the subject line.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Drop the peas.
I can't stop shelling the peas because if I stop shelling the peas, then dinner won't be ready on time.
Oh, God. And then everything will be a catastrophe.
Well, you won't have dinner.
That's a catastrophe.
That does feel like a catastrophe
it
when it happens, doesn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Very important.
So take my work seriously. Here.
I appreciate your labors, and I take them seriously.
Now, we also are not reviewing this week something the Dragon. What's it called?
Oh, yeah, I guess that was wide, too. I forgot about that one. Birth of the Dragon.
Birth of the Dragon.
Which Robert also reviewed for us and said had some like B-movie pleasures to it, but that unfortunately... somebody along the way decided that a movie about Bruce Lee needed to have a lot of time spent on a character played by Billy Magnuson.
Fantastic.
Yes. So, but apparently if you can work around the white guy who's in the middle of far too much of the movie,
the blonde devil.
The blonde, exactly.
At the heart of the film.
The actual story about Bruce Lee having this sort of legendary showdown with a Shaolin master early in his career is supposed to be kind of fun, but apparently the white elephant in the room is a bit of an annoyance.
Is an actual white elephant.
Yes.
Well, Billy Magnuson is
he's
significantly smaller than an elephant.
Yeah.
But,
the white buff guy in the room. He was crazily buff in Ingrid Goes West.
He was meant to be.
I know. I mean, it was
and
a character choice.
He was fantastic in Ingrid Goes West.
He was.
As well.
It's funny, the lead guy in Beach Rats, who also is like super ripped, I did a Q&A with Eliza Hittman at Outfest, and she said that when she and the costume designer first saw him without his shirt on, they were like, oh no, this is all wrong. Like, that was not at all how they had pictured the character looking.
Oh yeah?
But then it was like, no, that it makes perfect sense that that character would, like, subsume himself in, you know, having this sort of, like, outwardly, you know, this macho exterior and looking like all of his friends. Like, he and
all of his gym rat friends.
Exactly. Yeah. He and all of his friends look kind of alike. They've all got the same haircut. They've all got versions of the same body, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, no, I thought it was actually a perfect choice.
They all lift, bro.
Yeah, yeah. Totally, bro. They even lift. Yeah, so we didn't see Birth of the Dragon, but what did we see, Dave?
I don't know. No, we saw Good Time.
We saw Good Time.
Tell people what that is.
So Good Time is from the Safdie brothers, whose previous film I don't know.
They've got more than one previous film.
Oh, really?
And like you, I have not seen their previous
films.
Okay,
yeah.
Films. I've got some catching up to
do. I had missed out on their work.
With these guys.
This one premiered at Cannes, and I can see why. Robert Pattinson stars as a petty criminal who has been taking care of his developmentally disabled brother. The two of them pull a bank job that does not go well. The brother winds up getting arrested, and the Robert Pattinson character spends the rest of a very twitchy evening trying to cobble together enough money to bail the brother out. And that sounds like a movie you've seen before, but it is very much its own thing.
It absolutely is.
It starts out kind of being like the petty crime of Mice and Men, but then once the brother is out of the picture and it's all just Robert Pattinson running around and grinding his teeth and trying to figure out what to do and try to fix the situation.
Like Run, Lola, Run.
Yeah, it gets very tense. I think I would have liked it maybe to be tenser, because there are times where it slows down a bit, and I felt like it should have just been like one big cocaine teeth grind the whole time. But it does that a lot, and it does it enough to where I think it works. And his performance is great.
Okay, we'll get back to the whether or not it should have been more tense.
Mm-hmm.
Because
You're making faces at me.
I am making a face at you because I disagree about that.
Okay.
It is as tense as it ought to be. It necessarily takes detours and pit stops into moments of rest,
mm-hmm.
Where he has to regroup and figure out what's next. And toward the end, when things are necessarily, again, slowing down because actual tragedy is taking place, I think the film knows where it needs to go. And how quickly it needs to go.
Well, I'm not saying that it has to constantly be, you know, like peril, peril, peril. But in a movie like, say, After Hours, even in those moments where things slow down and where he is seemingly in a place of stasis, there's a dread that never goes away.
There is a dread that never goes away in this film.
I think there are some...
It is such an anxiety-producing movie.
There were moments to me where I felt it went a little slack.
I don't know what movie you saw.
Okay, well, we disagree.
This is an incredible film. I found it deeply upsetting. and again, much anxiety provoked by it. It's the kind of film where...
But I'll tell you, if I'm an easy touch for horror movies,
yeah,
you're an easy touch for anxiety.
I am. And when a movie really makes it happen, I respect that movie.
All right.
This is a film about dead-end people making bad, bad, bad decisions.
Yes.
Over and over and over again. It reminded me a lot of our former neighbors. Only I felt sympathy for the people in this film because they don't live next door to us. For 6 months earlier in this year, we had an actual meth dealer.
Yes.
Living next door to us in the apartment right next to ours.
Yes.
And it was 6 months of living hell. It was a nightmare.
Mm.
Every single thing they did was wrong. Every single thing they did was stupid and loud. Every single thing they did involved property destruction and the police being called. Every single thing they did eventually resulted in their arrests and evictions.
Yes.
I'm so glad they're gone. If I were making a movie about our next door neighbors, I would have to try to figure out a way to get a viewer like me to care.
Right.
Because these real-life people next door to us, I didn't care what their backstory was.
Yeah, your compassion was not stoked.
I had zero compassion for them because they were hell on earth.
Yes.
These characters in this film, they're kind of also hell on earth. The emotional hook into them is the character played by Benny Safdie. Benny Safdie is the co-director. He's also the sound guy. He's also the editor.
Wow.
Of the film.
And they co-wrote?
And he did not co-write. He co-directed.
I see.
Yeah. And so But he plays Pattinson's developmentally disabled brother.
Right.
And he's so good.
Yeah.
As this brother that I saw this movie at the Arclight with Gary Cotti, and he turns to me and he goes, is he acting? And I was like, he's the co-director of the film. Yes, he's acting. Also, he did a lot of other things in the movie, too.
Yeah, and it's not like...
He's a major player behind the camera. He's acting.
Is not, like I think somebody was saying, it's not a Dustin Hoffman sort of showy version of that kind of character.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's not actorly at all. No. It's the kind of... like, remember the first time you saw Gabri Sidibe in Precious, and you were thinking, is this... Did they just find this girl? Yeah. Is she really... And you worried that much more about her, you know, because you thought, oh no, do I have to think about actually having this person being taken care of in real life?
Right.
That's how good Gabi Sidibe is.
Yeah.
In Precious.
And then you would see interviews with her and she's like, oh my God.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, I'm a Valley girl. Like that's how she really is off camera. But as a newcomer, you were spun around by her. And that's because I have not seen any of the earlier Safdie Brothers films where sometimes Benny Safdie is in the movie.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know a thing about him. And so he was my hook in. But even more than the performances, the filmmaking style itself is simultaneously punishing and inviting. And
propulsive,
just magnetic. It just pushes you forward.
The score, very much
visually gorgeous, even when very ugly things are happening.
Mm.
The score is intense and harsh.
Yeah,
but you remember it.
Mm-hmm.
I was wrung out by the time it was over, and unhappy. And I think that means it's an effective film. A very effective film. I think it's great.
I think it mostly does what it sets out to do. I felt like there were times where the ball stops moving.
Mm.
And given that the kind of film that it is, that it's like one night where all these things have to happen and it just gets worse. And I should have felt more wrung out by the end of it. And I wanted to feel more wrung out by the end of it and I didn't, but you had that experience. So there you go.
The genius of the movie is that, in spite of the fact that Pattinson's character is the worst,
mm-hmm.
you want him to have an okay life.
Yeah.
You want things to calm down and slow down.
Weirdly enough, you want him to get the brother back, even though the brother is better off without him.
The brother is better off where he eventually winds up.
Yeah.
Even though he's miserable.
Mm.
And I would like to also talk about, for a moment, the brilliance of Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Thank you. I was just about to bring her up.
Who shows up as this screaming,
messed up, rich
entity. And she's not in the movie for very long, but you're not going to forget her.
Yeah. Boy, does she make an impression.
And
Barkhad Abdi, too.
And Barkhad Abdi as well. Now, there's a dude I've been rooting for.
Yes.
I remember when he got nominated for an Academy Award, and they did a profile about him in one of the major newspapers. I can't remember now if it was the New York Times or the LA Times. But the whole thing was, yes, I have an Academy Award nomination. I'm a taxi driver.
A limo driver. Like, he talked about how in previous years at the Oscars, he was, like, over, you know, in the parking lot of the Hollywood Bowl with all the other limos having driven some, like, star to the Oscars.
And right.
This year he was going, you know.
It's like at the LAFCA, the LA Film Critics Awards dinner, when I leave the proceedings to go take a break and walk around, the other security guys think that I'm a security guy.
I love that you call them the other security guys. As though you were one as well.
They're my bros.
They think you're one of them.
They think I'm one of them. It wasn't until this year that I stopped getting asked, who are you working for tonight? I'm like, I'm not. I'm a film critic. I'm like, oh, we thought you were.
I'm a film critic with this neck.
Yes. I shop for shirts at the 20-inch neck store.
Even if I may like it a little less than you, I like Good Time a lot and very strongly recommend it to people, for sure.
So, and then we watched Marjorie Prime.
Woo!
Speaking of films that have an emotional kick to them.
When you and I did participated in the writing of the book Screening Party with Dennis Hensley.
Yes.
There was somebody who said, I can't remember who now, but talking about Jaws, about how when they were kids, they were afraid of the ocean and like, you know, that something was going to come snag them. And then when he saw Jaws, it was like, oh my God, somebody designed this movie just to F with me.
Right.
And Marjorie Prime.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
So many of my buttons.
I know.
It was a difficult viewing experience.
Michael Almereyda directed this and wrote it. He's also the man who currently has the documentary Escapes in theaters right now. The documentary about Hampton Fancher, who wrote
Blade Runner,
who adapted it for the screen, and who is also the screenwriter for Blade Runner 2049.
And I believe Marjorie Prime is based on a play.
It's based on a play. And Almereyda took this and he adapted it. Mm-hmm. For the screen. It stars John Hamm,
right,
Tim Robbins, Gina Davis, and Lois Smith. If you don't know who Lois Smith is, when you see her, you will know who she is. She's a character actress. She's been working for decades, since the 50s. She was in East of Eden opposite James Dean. That's how long she's been around. She's in her mid-80s now.
She was in Twister.
Helen Hunt's mom in Twister, if you remember that.
Yeah, she was Susan Sarandon's mom in Dead Man Walking.
Yeah.
I want to say, is she the one who has that amazing scene in, what's the Tom Cruise movie with the precogs?
Minority Report?
Minority Report.
She might be in Minority Report.
I think
Report.
She's in Minority Report. But she's just this amazing character actor that you've seen in a million things, and she's the female that guy.
So, she's the star of the film. She is the center performance of the film. And she plays a woman whose husband has died. I would like to announce that Alonso Duralde has hit the microphone for the second time in a week.
It's been a long day.
Which used to be my jam.
I know.
Now it is turning into yours.
I don't mean to cut into your...
That's what I'm saying.
Your role on the program.
The bingo card... of repeating motifs on this podcast is usually about me hitting the microphone, but this week it's been you.
Lois Smith is indeed the lady in Minority Report.
Okay, so her husband has died.
Yes,
and
this is set in the future.
The film is set in the very near future. Okay, the film opens and you see her sitting in a chair. And he's on a couch, and they're talking. And she's talking to him about their shared past. And she says, what was the movie we went to see when you proposed to me? And that's when you think, wait a second. John Hamm is in his 40s, and this woman is in her 80s. Are they married? And then she talks about him having died.
Right.
And you realize that something weird is going on. And what the weird thing that is going on is that John Hamm is a digital...
Hologram
of her late husband, who has been programmed to be the younger version of her late husband. And it comforts her. It gives her someone to talk to.
She has some level of dementia.
A little bit.
So she has chosen, you know, like kind of her... favorite memory of her husband, like the favorite era of his life.
Yeah.
So, you know, and he was older than her, so that was like about the age he was when they got married.
So then, time goes on.
And her daughter is Gina Davis, and her son-in-law is Tim Robbins. Gina Davis is a little skittish about this hologram of her dead father in the house, but Tim Robbins keeps telling her that it's good for the mother, that he, like, calms her down. The John Hamm hologram will tell her, like, why don't you have a spoonful of peanut butter? You should eat something.
Right.
You know? And the things that are very sort of therapeutic for her.
Just fast forward a little bit in time, and now you realize that Lois Smith's character has passed away. And now she is a hologram talking to her daughter, Gina Davis.
Right.
That is as far into the plot as I want to go.
I was going to say, yeah, let's not.
Because I don't want to spoil the ending and what comes next. But there are some things that I really, really love about this movie. Overall, I think it's really terrific. But the specifics of what I love are that it is a science fiction movie where people sit in a house and talk to each other.
I haven't watched a lot of Black Mirror, but my understanding of that show is that it's about the notion of how is technology going to change our lives, and right. In Black Mirror, anyway, the idea is like, what's the underside of that? What's the danger of that? And in this one, it's not so much about being a warning as much as being a kind of an idea about how memory works, yes. and how like family memory works, and the stories that get passed down, and whose version of the truth is what we remember.
What gets altered for the sake of telling a story? What gets altered for the sake of
covering up painful things?
The comfort of the
listener.
The listener, the least harmful of these changes involves the initial conversation, where it turns out that they went on their first date to see My Best Friend's Wedding, the Julia Roberts, what's-his-face movie?
Rupert Everett.
Rupert Everett and...
Dermot Mulroney.
Dermot Mulroney. Cameron Diaz.
Yeah.
And she doesn't think that's a cool enough movie to have as the memory, even though that's the fact.
Yeah.
And she says, couldn't we have gone to an old-timey movie theater with velvet seats and watched Casablanca? Couldn't that have been the moment we fell in love and you proposed to marry me and stuff like that? And he was like, but we didn't see that. We saw My Best Friend's Wedding. And so, and that comes back later in the film. But what I really, really love is the idea that you use memory to sustain your present. And it's something that everybody does, whether you are conscious of it or not. Everything that ever happened to you is part of your life today. You know, we were just talking about this on one of the other shows, LKTV, yeah? About no. On Linoleum Knife and Fork, we were talking about my Partridge Family lunchbox that when I was in second grade.
Yes.
And how vitally important that was to me. Because that TV program was so important to me. Because it was this refuge in my own childhood. Like, I could go into that family for once a week. One time a week, I could go into that family and be in that family. And they were so much cooler than my actual family. And so, the memory of that keeps me, it's a part of me. It's a part of my life. It's a part of how I live my life now. I like to make sure that this house, this family of you and me, is the kind of place where people want to come to. They want to come over. They want to eat dinner. They want to hang out. I like that. And so I try to make that happen as much as I possibly can. And it's because when I was a kid, I wanted that kind of household. Obviously, we are not in a band together.
No.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, there's a great speech in the film where somebody talks about one of the theories of memory is the idea memories aren't these things that you put in a well and keep going back to them, that when you're remembering something, you're actually remembering the last time you remembered it.
Yes.
And that's why memories grow fuzzy over time, because it's like the copy of a copy. And I had never really thought about it that way, that is the chain of how memory works and how anecdotes and all those things come together, you know? I found this movie just profoundly moving. The performances are all great.
They really are. Everyone in the film is spot on.
I haven't seen Gina Davis or Tim Robbins be this good in a long time.
Right.
I really do much. I mean, I can't remember the last movie either of them in, frankly.
Exactly.
But yeah, they're terrific. Mika Levy, who is one of my favorite film composers these days, did the score.
Yeah.
And again, it's a little off-putting, but it's exactly right.
The production design is perfect.
Yeah.
These people have plenty of money but everything is mushroom colored in their home.
Yes.
And so the immediate present day surroundings sort of fade into the background and you're caught up in their conversations instead.
Yeah.
It's a film full of beautiful furnishings that you're not paying any attention to.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's one where it's set in a near future that is completely recognizable,
right,
and where time continues to pass and everything sort of stays the same because it's all this sort of beachside casual,
right,
you know, thing. So yeah, there's no like things that jump out as being super time specific.
I it's very moving. It's really a beautiful story about love and being loved and caring for people.
I also like how they weave in the role that art plays in our lives as far as, you know, whether it's we got engaged after seeing my best friend's wedding or going to see the Christo, the Gates in Central Park.
Right.
Because movies don't talk about that stuff that much.
No, they don't.
It's very rare that characters will talk specifically about music or books or TV or movies or whatever in it as a touchstone of their lives. And so often, even if you're not like somebody like us who makes a living doing this stuff, those things still are a touchstone, and they do, right, you do think about them when you think about, like, there's a reason why that whole Song of the Summer concept, when you think about certain summers and where you were, what you were doing, what song was popular then becomes a part of that memory. And so this movie really addresses that in a way that felt very true, but subtle at the same time. I was a wreck.
The answer is Mambo Number 5.
Yes, Lou Bega's shadow looms large.
Yes.
Over our lives.
My life.
Well, and really, you know, and I have to say, I did respond just immediately to the fact that when you and I got married,
yes,
at the movie theater that we rented to do it in,
they were showing
my best friend's wedding that week. So yeah, go see Marjorie Prime. It is, I think, just playing in a few markets right now, but hopefully it's getting out there. And if not, it'll be streaming at some point. It is one of my favorite films of 2017 so far.
And now, Morrissey.
Oh, yes.
You guys, there's a Morrissey movie out.
Oh, mother, I can feel.
Finish it.
The soil falling over my head.
That is not the worst Morrissey impersonation I've ever heard, but it's close.
It's not really part of my repertoire.
And yet you chose to do it anyway.
But I like the idea of when Kermit the Frog does Morrissey.
Okay, don't.
Okay, fine.
Don't.
Okay.
Don't do that. Morrissey currently occupies the space of the problematic fave,
mm-hmm,
with me.
Not just you, I'm sure.
Oh, no, not just me. You know, he's one of the founding members of the Smiths.
Mm-hmm.
Very important band of the 1980s. And now he's all, like, pro-Brexit and saying things about immigrants, and I'm just like, what happened to you, dude? What do you?
He's
been an a-hole, but he was my a-hole.
Yeah, I know. Now he's turning into Brigitte Bardot.
He's got me worried. He's got me. He's.
Nancy Sinatra needs to give him a good talking.
He's
to.
Bugging me lately quite a bit. Anyway, so they made a movie about his early life, which is perfect for any of y'all who are irritated by him in his present incarnation. This is a film, a biopic, starring Jack Lowden, I think is how you say his name. He's in Dunkirk. And Jessica Brown Findlay, who was Lady Sybil on Downton Abbey. She plays Linda Sterling, who is Morrissey's lifelong friend, and she's an artist in her own right. She designed the early Buzzcocks record sleeves, Orgasm Addict, that kind of stuff. And they've been friends for over 40 years. But the film is about...
Is she also a character in 24-Hour Party People?
I don't remember if she is. Although there is that line at the end of 24 Hour Party People where he says, I wish I'd signed the Smiths. The Smiths did send their demo to Factory Records where it was rejected.
Funny.
Yeah, the Factory didn't want anything to do with the Smiths. So the film starts in the 1970s when Morrissey is still in school and his life is all about, you know, records and books and movies and being a, you know, a pain to the people around him. He's snotty and superior, and he knows that he's got all of this talent inside of himself that he can't figure out where to put it. He can't find a band that will fit with him. He briefly joins a band with a friend, Billy Duffy, who then leaves to go to London, where he eventually becomes famous in his own right as a member of The Cult.
Right.
The band, The Cult. And
not just any old cult.
Not just any old cult. And so the film is about that stalled period in your late adolescence. If you're gonna, you want to go out into the world and make a thing about yourself. You want to make yourself into something. You want to invent yourself into something better than what you have and better than what you're being offered. You know, you see him in various dead-end jobs where he acts like he's above it all and is a jerk and a pain.
And there's always someone there with a big nose who knows.
And yeah, and he's You feel for him because you know where he's going.
Right.
You know that he's Morrissey. Like, everyone's walking around going, Steven. You know, that's his actual name. Yeah. His last name is Morrissey.
Right. Portrait of the Artist as a young man, then.
Portrait of the Artist as a young pain in the ass.
Right.
And the, but you like him. You like him because you know that he's going to write all these really great songs. And he's going to meet Johnny Marr, and they're going to have a brief phone conversation. And when they do, you know, the camera just is on that phone. The camera is building tension. Like, it wants Morrissey to hurry up and go get a pen so he can write down Johnny Marr's phone number. And the camera just sits on that empty receiver. Like, the receiver is lying on the bench in the hallway, waiting for Morrissey to go get the damn pen. And the film goes all the way up to the, you know, the in Smith's lore, it all began the day that Johnny Marr walked up to Morrissey's door and knocked on the door, finally, to offer him, "Would you like to be in a band with me?" And the movie goes from, he's like 16, 17, to the beginning of, just before the band begins. So this is not a
band. So it's an origin story.
It is an origin story. It is not a band about the Smiths, necessarily. It's a band, it's a movie about
how Morrissey got there.
How do you become the person you want to be? As a film, it is not entirely successful. It's not garbage by any stretch. And if you're a Morrissey fan, if you're a Smiths fan, you want to watch this, if for no other reason than the fan service that it provides. Because the name of the film is England Is Mine. And I don't even know if I said the name of the film at the top of this review, but the name of the film is England Is Mine. And if you know the song Still Ill, you know that the lyric goes, "England is mine, it owes me a living." So at one of these dead-end, terrible jobs with the abusive employer says to him one day, "Steven, I don't owe you a living." And you sit there and you smile to yourself because you're like, no, it's true. You don't owe him a living. The entire country owes him a living.
So this is like people we know watching, like, Star Wars prequels or Marvel movies where you're like, ha, 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 I see what you're doing there.
Look at that little thing over there. I know what that thing is.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's Mr. Shankly or whatever. Yeah.
No. Right. Exactly. And so he even says to a job center employer, a man who's trying to place him in jobs, And he's, you know, having him on. He's just winding him up. And he says something to the guy. And he goes, you could be a poet. What if you were the best poet in the world? Don't you want that? Don't you want to try to be the best poet in the world? And the guy's like, no, what I want is for you to take one of these job cards and get out of my face. He doesn't say that. It's not a quote, but...
Right. Leave my office.
But that becomes, frankly, Mr. Shankly. Hmm. You know, oh, I didn't realize you wrote poetry. I didn't realize you wrote such bloody awful poetry. You know. The performances are fine. Jack Lowden is, you know, good at making you feel sorry for this guy who's really bummed out. The woman who plays his mother, and I'm blanking on her name, I'm very sorry, she gives, it's a very brief performance, but it's quite moving because... Morrissey has always loved his mum, and she supported him as in his desires to go be this person. You know, and there's a scene at the end where she says, you're going to quit. You're going to quit doing this. You're going to pretend that it never meant anything to you. You, all these books, all this typewriter I bought you, this, you know, everything that you are, everything that I was, you know, trying to help you be. You're going to abandon all that? And he's like, you know, almost crying. And she keeps telling him, no, you have to go. You have to go do this.
Now, you read the Morrissey memoir, right?
Yes.
Does this hew to it fairly closely? Or?
Well, there's a whole lot in that memoir. I mean, it is 600 pages.
Well, I'm not saying is all the memoir in the movie, but is everything in the movie from the memoir?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I'm not remembering anything, you know, out of the ordinary.
And is the movie as coy about Morrissey's sexuality as Morrissey tends to be?
No. Well, no. So here's what you don't quite understand about his sexuality. Early on in the 80s, his entire stance was, I'm celibate. I don't do anything with anybody, and I'm not interested in anyone, because people are stupid and terrible, and I'm better than them. That was the Morrissey stance. Questions of gay or straight never came up. In the book, he talks about relationships he's had with men. Ah. And so, but he, to this day, in spite of the fact that he has openly had relationships with men, he refuses to use terminology like homosexuality and heterosexuality, because he's an artist and he's above all that. Like, to accept Morrissey as Morrissey, you have to accept Morrissey telling you how things are going to be with Morrissey.
I see.
And that he's better than you, and you don't have the power to tell him what he has to say and not say, be and not be. This was fine for a while until he started talking about Brexit. That's just me personally.
I see.
And honestly, I only ever paid attention to the snooty vegetarian / veganism angle of his life. So, if you don't care about Morrissey, if you don't like Morrissey, if you don't like the Smiths, you don't care about the Smiths, you don't watch this movie. There's nothing here for you. There's some really nice cinematography. It looks really good. The period details look good. But it is a film about a man who has not yet become exciting. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's what I said in the review. I wrote a review of this for The Wrap, so you can go read the whole review if you like. You should. It would make me very happy if you did.
We've got someone who will be interesting later.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I saw Red Christmas.
Oh, Red Christmas. I didn't even write that down on our to-do list because
I forgot about it. Which is being released in August, I guess, so they can put out the DVD in November.
That's their only hope.
Pretty much. It is an Australian horror film that stars Dee Wallace. And Dee Wallace is about the only interesting thing in it. Well, not entirely, but one of the few interesting things in it. It is about a family, a dysfunctional family that is celebrating Christmas in Australia. And of course, since it's Australia, it's, you know, the middle of summer. And there are a lot of quibbles within the family. One of the daughters is pregnant, and she's very sort of you know, kind of funny, but also mean. There's another sister who is very tamped down and married this clergyman, and she wants to have kids but can't have them and doesn't want to do, like, any kind of, what's the word, you know, fecundity therapy. What am I thinking of here?
Fertility.
Fertility treatments. Thank you.
You can remember the word fecundity. Yet you get stymied over fertility.
You know how it is when a word leaps out of your head and you have to go into the thesaurus for
it. I know is what it, how it is with you. I know how it is with you and words and...
Anyway.
Yeah.
Then there's another sibling who has Down syndrome, but he is, you know, he has a job and he's actually very funny and sarcastic.
Right.
And so, you know, they have their various squabbles and disagreements. And then this bizarre hooded, like, kind of bandaged figure shows up at the doorstep. And they're kind of like, okay, come in.
And it's Santa.
No.
It's the real Santa, and he's here to murder you.
It is Dee Wallace's child from 20 years ago that she thought she had aborted.
Okay.
And so then, yeah, so the movie has right. this whole, and you can tell in the press materials, they're really like patting themselves on the back and they're like, they're taking on the whole abortion thing, but they have nothing, they have nothing to say about the whole abortion thing except to exploit it as a horror movie angle.
Okay. It seems completely irresponsible.
It's grotesque. And then what any of this has to do with Christmas is anybody's guess. But then of course, you know, he's mad and winds up like killing off.
Christmas is a time of misery. So,
I suppose so. Yeah. And starts killing everybody off, and, like, you know, finally night falls and the inside of the house is lit only by, like, Christmas lighting, so that's kind of cool.
Right.
And, you know, obviously the fact that one of the daughters is pregnant is that becomes an issue, and, you know, Dee Wallace sort of reminds you that, you know, hey, I was the pregnant possible victim in The Hills Have Eyes, you know.
Right.
But it is just generally kind of a crappy slasher movie. It doesn't look good. It's not smart. It plays with fire in terms of trying to be about controversial subject matter, but has nothing to say about it or
right.
an angle to take on it or a stance even. It's just tacky. And as a Christmas movie, it's nothing all that special either. So, and it's trying to make you think about Black Christmas, not just in the title, but even like the title card itself has like the Roman numeral date
yes,
on it. Like
right.
that sort of vintagey 70s
yeah.
type of thing.
Right.
It's not good.
Okay. You got a DVD pick of the week?
I do. Minority Report, because we were talking about Lois Smith. I was reminded, like, here in this movie that's this, like, Spielberg, Tom Cruise, sci-fi cop thing, suddenly you get this one amazing scene with Lois Smith, and I think, you know, there's a world where there would have been an awards campaign for her for that movie, and there wasn't, but there should have been. And there is one for her for Marjorie Prime, and I hope it goes places, because she is a vet, and she's done a lot of great work and never really gotten her due for it. So, yeah, check out. You may have even seen Minority Report and forgotten about the Lois Smith scene, but go back and look at it, and you will be knocked out by how great she is in, like, 5 or 10 minutes of screen time.
I got my mind on my Morrissey. My Morrissey on my mind.
Yes.
So my DVD pick is A Taste of Honey.
Ah.
Tony Richardson directed this film in 1961. It was based on a play by Sheila Delaney.
It's part of the kitchen sink school, right?
Yeah, it sure is. And here is what it's about. A 17-year-old girl lives with an alcoholic mother. She meets a sailor. She gets pregnant by the sailor. She moves out. And she moves in with a gay friend. And then they form a kind of a family.
Right.
Yeah.
And the sailor's black, right?
He is, yes.
Which for 1962 England
is was a big deal. Yeah. Sorry, that detail slipped out of my head. So she's going to have a biracial baby in 1961, and her best friend is a gay guy that she lives with. And
yeah.
So it's full of social
taboos.
Yeah, yeah. This film is so heavily, such a huge influence on Morrissey. that to watch it is to feel as though you are in a Smith's song before before they could have ever even existed.
Right.
Everything from Smith's record cover sleeves to songs, Sheila Take a Bow, is, you know, that name figures in.
Interesting.
All the way down to lines of dialogue.
Huh.
From A Taste of Honey that wound up in Smith's song.
Okay.
Are you going out tonight? Well, I would, but I haven't got anything to wear.
Ah.
Joe says to the sailor, I'll probably never see you again, which is a line in Hand and Glove. Hmm. So it's things like that. You know, I dreamt about you last night and I fell out of bed twice. That sort of thing. You want to know where lyrics come from in those Smith songs? You watch those old movies that he watched. And if you read his biography, you read St. Morrissey by Mark Simpson, or you read the memoir by Morrissey himself, you'll get it all. And this is just a fantastic movie on its own.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, so
there's a criterion of it now, right?
There is a criterion of it now, yeah.
Awesome. Have we letters?
We got a bunch of too many. Here's one from Alice. First and foremost, I love your podcast. You guys are a joy.
Yay.
That said, I'd like to get something off my chest. Oh, it frustrates boy. Me.
Here it comes.
About film critics in general. And that is blaming the screenwriter for bad movies. Okay, I'm going to read through the whole letter, and then we'll talk about our stance on this issue.
Okay.
And about our stance on this particular screenwriter in general. Okay. You recently discussed the work of Alan Loeb. I don't know Mr. Loeb personally, and honestly, I'm not even that familiar with his work. I did, however, read his script for The Only Living Boy in New York back when it was making the rounds, and I assure you it was spectacular. What critics don't seem to understand, or at least fail to mention, is that the original script is usually bastardized beyond recognition by the time it reaches the screen. Multiple producers will ask for changes, the actors will add their input, the editor will add, remove, rearrange, etc., and the director will do whatever the hell he or she wants to do. Not to mention, there are usually half a dozen or more uncredited writers who come in and add their stamp. Also, actors' performances, set design, costumes, music, etc., all have a huge effect on what you see on screen, as opposed to what was on the page. The processing that happens between script and finished film is so significant that blaming the screenwriter for a bad movie is like getting a crappy cheeseburger from McDonald's and blaming the cow. Hollywood is not lining up to buy bad scripts, let alone produce them. The slushy pile on every producer's desk is a mile high. Oh, the slush pile, not the slushy pile. Sorry.
They also drink a lot of frozen beverages.
For a script to rise to the top, it has to be excellent. If it ends up resulting in a crummy movie, there are a lot of reasons why that could be, but in most cases, it's not the fault of the screenwriter. I apologize for singling you two out for something that all film critics are guilty of, but this drives me bonkers, and I needed to rant. I still love you. Screenwriters rule. Okay.
All right, Alice. First of all, we love you too. Second of all...
Hang on.
Shenanigans!
Hang on. We do know the work of Mr. Loeb. We have seen the finished film products of his screenwriting imagination. Collateral Beauty. The Space Between Us, a.k.a. Candy Bones. And now this. I agree with you. Okay. Alice, I agree with you. I have said many times on this show that it's impossible to blame any one person for a film that sucks. You can't blame the actors. You can't even blame the actors if they're giving bad performances because they're not in control of what take got used in the film. They may have given a great performance and all of their good takes wound up on the avid dump, okay? The screenwriter can have everything taken away from her or himself. Okay. And so I agree with you on this. You can't blame the writer. The times that I will blame a writer is when I see a consistency in their work. And I see a consistency in the work of Alan Loeb.
The films of Alan Loeb, at least
bonkers consistency.
The most recent three that have come out in the last year are all terrible in the same way.
Yeah.
And they are terrible in a way that has to do with the structure of the script and Socceroo, you know, reveals in the third act. And there are themes here. So it's not like
really wacky and ridiculous themes.
Yeah, it's not like different people took a crack at this guy's work and turned them into different kinds of bad movies. His last three scripts have all been the same kind of bad movie in the same parallel ways that suggest that they were there on the page.
If you saw the original script for The Only Living Boy in New York and you say it was brilliant, then I can only believe what you say.
We've been told by people...
But something happened.
We were told by somebody that maybe not the first version, but that the version of the script that they read some 10 years ago or so, that turned out that the Jeff Bridges character in that script was a figment of the lead character's imagination.
Which would have scanned...
Which is very Loeb-ish.
Perfectly well with other examples of the finished product that we have seen,
and had they
that
kept
his name is still on.
And had they kept that idea in, that would have been terrible also.
Right.
I mainly say shenanigans for this reason. If we can never blame a screenwriter for a bad movie because so many other people have power over that element of the film and so many changes are made,
right?
Then we can also never credit a screenwriter with a good movie for the same reason. If the screenwriter loses all agency when a movie goes south, then it's only fair then that if a movie works, you're like, oh, well, I guess it was rescued by the producers and the directors and the actors and the editors and the set designers and not that hack writer.
I don't want to get into that sort of circular sort of argument with you. What I want to say is that each case to me feels different. There are times when you're in the hands of like an auteur who has control over his finished work.
Yeah, Woody Allen's scripts are shot exactly the way he wants them to be shot and edited the way he wants them to be edited and all that other stuff.
Martin Scorsese, same way. Smaller European kind of directors, people who don't have a lot of interference.
The Dardenne brothers.
The Dardennes. You know, people like that. They're gonna get their way. They have seized the means of production.
Yes.
So I don't think we can always say one or the other. You can't always say, oh yeah, we can always blame this person or we can never blame this person. I think it depends on the product that you're talking, the very specific film that you're talking
about. I agree with you, but I'm just responding to her thing. Her saying never means is me saying, well, then always. Like, I agree with you. The truth lies somewhere in the middle. But you're right. There are auteurs where we know that they got exactly the movie that they wanted to make. And then there's people like Alan Loeb whose movies suck in the same way from different directors and who before making these sort of like horrible would-be middle-brow adult dramas was writing garbage for Adam Sandler.
Right.
So Alan Loeb knows what Alan Loeb did.
We're only speaking today about Alan Loeb.
Yes.
I agree with you, Alonzo, about this particular person. Because I have seen these same films. And you're right. They do all go off the rails in similar ways. Not identical ways. Things are different from script to script, from film to film. But the level of preposterousness.
Yes.
The preposterosity of these films suggests to me that this guy...
is the link.
is the creative link that makes them all terrible, also hilarious,
right,
and completely watchably bad.
I got into the briefest of Twitter skirmishes with Mr. Max Landis.
Okay.
Because in my review of...
Did you tell him that I loved American Ultra?
I did not.
Why not?
It was a very brief skirmish.
It's such a good movie.
It is not. Anyway, in my review of, I think, Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, right. I mentioned the screenwriters in talking about the film. And he was like, you know, why would you mention the screenwriters when clearly they have no power in the big studio, blah, 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 blah. And I said, because if whenever critics don't mention the screenwriters, we get blamed for forgetting the screenwriters.
Right.
And we're not privy to all of the behind-the-scenes action as to who said what and made this decision or whatever. So all we have to go on are the credits, the final contractual on-the-screen credits. So, yes, there may be 80 people at fault for why the BVS Superman the screenplay is terrible, but the only ones I can call out are the three people whose names are actually on it.
The letter that I just opened up in my email,
yes,
is also about Alan Loeb. How did this come to be?
I didn't realize it was more than one.
Hello, David Alonso. This is from Reese. If you could fix any bad movie, which would it be?
Oh, right.
And how would you change it? The most recent bad movie I would change would be Collateral Beauty.
Right, I forgot about that. Yes.
If the movie was only about the Will Smith and Naomi Harris characters getting to know one another from the grief meetings and it followed their friendship over a short period of time, then they revealed that they were once married and that they were both grieving over the same child, this could have been an interesting movie.
Yeah, I think for a twist like that, it might work better for sort of like a 50-minute episode of an anthology or something. I don't know, you could build an entire movie on that, you know, sassy reveal. But I'd say, yes, taking out the hiring actors and then having those hired actors be the actual, you know, Love, Death, and Time could only help. How would I fix a movie?
Oh, hi. I fixed a movie.
God, that's an old joke.
Sorry, it's a dumb inside joke that would take too long to explain.
It would.
I'm sorry I made it.
What is a bad movie that I could fix? I mean, I think you could fix King Arthur because the coming of age montage quickly run through is such a cool idea that I think if you could then just sort of come up with something more interesting to do with actual Arthur once he becomes king, or in the once he's an adult. Might have worked better. I don't know. I guess I'm fixing a movie where I liked the first 10 minutes. I don't know. Not my job. Nothing comes to mind. I'll if I come up with one, we'll mention it later.
I can't think of a movie that I would want to fix. Because there are two kinds of bad movies. They're the kind that are so boring on every level that I just can't stomach another minute of watching them. And then there are the ones that are so crazy and bad that I am glad they are as they are.
I'll say this. I think that if you had put somebody who wasn't Dane DeHaan in Valerian,
right,
that movie gets like 30 to 50% better.
Right. Right.
So there's mine.
Sorry, yeah, I'll have to think about this.
Mm.
This is from Aaron. Not our friend Aaron.
No.
I mean, Aaron, you are our friend because you're our listener, but, you know.
You're not the Aaron who lives in Long Beach and tells Dave the terrible reality shows he needs to watch.
Correct. Gentlemen, I'm listening to your older episodes.
Oh, dear.
And particularly enjoying people's stories about odd things happening to them in movie theaters. May I share one of my own? Please do. I spent good money to see Batman and Robin in the theater when it came out, and for some reason the movie was projected in the wrong aspect ratio.
Oh.
Everyone looked incredibly bulked out. Regular people looked like Schwarzenegger, and Schwarzenegger looked like a god. The opening fight was a Wagnerian tumult of massive, beefy bodies. And I was thrilled. This is what a super-duper movie should be like.
But Joel Schumacher is now kicking himself that he didn't just release it this way.
Then they cut to Alicia Silverstone, and she looked big. The audience gasped and giggled, and some dude shot out of his seat and made a mad dash for the exit, presumably to tell management about the projection problem. They fixed it a minute later, and that was the end of my pleasure. With Batman and Robin. I would love to see the entire movie projected in accidental thick vision. In closing, it would make me so happy if you would reintroduce one old school detail to the show, specifically Alonzo pointing out that Linoleum Knife is on Get Glue, but that you're listed as a TV show and you're trying to change that.
That takes me back. Get Glue's not even a site anymore.
They don't exist anymore.
No, no.
Well, guess why they're not a site anymore? Because they kept listing us as a TV show.
That's what they get.
I'm glad they're gone. How do you like that? Get Glue. We're done.
Oh, okay.
That's the end of everything.
Well, we are going to have an episode next week, but it's going to be a little after Labor Day because that's when I get back from Vegas. So nothing really major opens this next week except for like the Goon sequel, which I'll talk about. I'll give you the skinny on the stuff that I see in Venice. If you want to read my reviews from Venice as they happen, go to thewrap.com, where I will be filing reviews while I'm over there. And go check out our friends on the internet. Go to christylemire.com. Listen to Cancel Too Soon with Bibbs and Whitney, and Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, and The Schmoes Know, and The Comics Canon, and Sewers of Paris, and the Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. Subscribe to this program for free at iTunes. And while you're there, leave us a review. It really does super help because there's so many dang podcasts. We all need a leg up. You can also leave us positive feedback at all the places that we stream. Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, etc., etc. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at LinoleumCast. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Go visit him at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And hey, join our club.
Hey.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. If you like this show, we offer tons more content for our subscribers. We have LKTV, a podcast of the television, Linoleum Knife and Fork, a podcast of the food, a.k.a. a food cat podcast hosted by two film critics, and Linoleum Nights, and it's a
podcast of the evening.
There you go. That's as good a way to describe it as anything. And other fun prizes, so go check that out. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. And we are looking forward to the end of summer and the beginning of fall movies and maybe some good ones maybe happening. I don't know. I'm seeing some cool stuff in Venice.
What kind of a weird statement was that anyway?
I was just thinking about the broader picture, the fact that this is our last pre-Labor Day podcast. And so, you know, we're about to change movie seasons, and summer and fall are very different.
You just sounded weirdly hosty there for a minute, and I just was thinking.
Oh, pardon me.
Please stop behaving like that.
I'm hosting a podcast. It shouldn't sound like I'm hosting a podcast.
Not in front of company. Please.
I'll save that for a special alone time.
Yes.
All right. Anyway, thanks for listening. We will catch you guys after Labor Day. And until then,
goodbye.